The longer I live, the longer I'm on the spiritual path, the more respect I have for how complicated it is. The more I get to know people and know people well, the more I see how just interwoven everything is, all our thinking, all our experiences, just walking around being ourselves is such a confusing and often complicated reality. All of us know this. We get ourselves involved with work and education and companions, and sometimes we give birth to children and then have to raise them, and then their whole karma comes into play, and just everything just seems to spin endlessly out of control. And when we want to try to sort of cut a clear path through it, it's really not so obvious what's connected to what, where we should go, what's right. When we just start thinking with our intellects, it's so easy to rationalize and justify just all different points of view. I know when I first came to Ananda Village, when I was 24 years old, and the first years that I was there, I'll skip into a different situation, about 15 years later, more than that, almost 20 years later, Swami Kriyananda asked David and I to come and live here, where we've been now for 25 years. I can't make all those numbers add up, so it's something like that. But I was in contact then on a regular basis with a lot of people who were really just beginning to find out about the spiritual path. And I was counseling this woman, and she was describing some situation she was dealing with. And all of a sudden, by the grace of God, really, my whole consciousness sort of transported itself back to being 24 and 25 years old. The age was less important in terms of my physical body, its youth, or anything like that. But I myself was moved back to the point where I was just starting on the spiritual path. And I could see, I could feel in my own heart how many different forces are always playing against us. And I felt that my own beginning years, the first 5 or 6 years especially, there was no clarity in my mind. It was like a cyclone, very fast moving, always having new ideas, really enjoying all of these new thoughts, you know, like this all the time. And if I had tried to follow any straight line intellectually, well, there was none. It would have just been going in circles. And at the same time, there was a completely other reality, which I couldn't have articulated at the time, and it was more clear in retrospect. It was like we live on so many levels simultaneously. And in our culture, American culture especially, we have this really deep devotion to our intelligence and to our rational process. The Indian culture is more designed to develop intuition, the way Swami Kriyananda described it. Cultures are blending now more, but even 30, 40 years ago, he said the Indian culture is all designed to develop intuition. When it works, you have phenomenal consciousness, but there's no fallback position, he said. You know, so if it doesn't make it to pure intuition, there's not necessarily a lot of real rational force behind it. My friend and I once were helping an Indian family in San Francisco just to move. And the woman was a very good example of a kind of flow of energy. She was not an engineer. So many of you dear Indian people who now live in our country are engineers, and so none of this applies. But this woman was not an engineer. And she asked my friend and I to inventory her books so she could pack them. And we had very little experience outside the American culture. Neither of us had traveled yet at that point. And we thought, sure, we can do this really easily. And I'll be darned if we couldn't get the same number no matter how many times we counted the books. It was sort of like we were coming in with this real rational, we can do this kind of, we can organize this. This woman had a very flowy way sort of doing things, and we were kind of a little disdainful of her flow, and we just kept counting those books. Finally, we were just laughing hysterically. You know, was it 20 books? Was it 26? Was it 14? Was it 91? We just could not bring anything into order, you know, with our little brains. It was like a force trying to speak to us on a much deeper level that says, you know, that the most important thing in the world is not necessarily to have all your little orderly thoughts. And that isn't really necessarily where your life is happening from at all. And thinking back to my first years on the path, I was living simultaneously in two completely different realities. One of them was this energetic spin, which I would call my intellect, which was just having a heyday. It wasn't in conflict, it was just everywhere, making up ideas constantly, left and right, analyzing myself with just ridiculous lack of self-understanding, explaining to everyone all these things that weren't at all true, just on and on. But another part of me, which was my soul, there wasn't the slightest hesitation or the slightest lack of knowing. It knew exactly where it was, my divine self. It knew exactly where it was, exactly what it was doing, and unerringly it went forward, which is the infinite calling its child home again. I'd felt this great good karma. I was talking to some friends recently about just this great good karma out of this vast sea of this world to hear that still small voice within, which says, there's a way. You don't have to just live randomly in this world. You don't have to just hope for the best. There's an iron cable that links our heart to the divine. And once we find that, it just transcends everything. And God is amused while the rest of us just spins around it. But that's all that's happening to us. In the reading today, we're talking about this web of karma that we can't see from where we stand because it's just too complicated for us to look at the edge of it and know what we're looking at. It's only when the masters look at it from above that they see how all those different pieces come together. And our success on the spiritual path is a fascinating combination of the necessity to be highly involved and highly energetic with our intellectual self, and at the same time to put that intellectual self in service of the inner understanding, in service of the divine. Swami Kriyananda describes himself when he first came to Master when he himself was 22, and he was a very strongly intellectually oriented person. The fact even of realizing that what he was looking for was spiritual truth was a total shock to him. It had never really crossed his mind until the facts were overwhelming that God was what he was looking for. And as he himself said, if he had prayed to God instead of thinking so much about him, he could have made much faster progress. But when he got to Master, when to Yogananda, and became his disciple, which once he read Autobiography of a Yogi, he said he wasn't convinced necessarily even of the ideas in the book, but he was utterly convinced of Yogananda himself, and just felt that the kind of call that I was speaking about, where nothing else had the same weight. You know, where he was going, leaving New York to come to California, what he would do, what he didn't even realize that Yogananda had an organization or that there was any kind of a system. He had one direct experience. He looked into Yogananda's eyes on the cover of Autobiography of a Yogi. There was a recognition. He read the book and he was overwhelmed by the vibrations of the master. So he just dropped everything. Absolutely everything. And as he tells the story, it's so sweet. His father was an oil geologist for Esso and worked mostly overseas. And just before Swamiji was called by Master to come to California and be his disciple, his father was called by his company to move to Egypt. Okay, this is 1948, too. This is not just flying back and forth like we do nowadays. This was getting on a ship and traveling for, you know, many days. And then just before he found Autobiography of a Yogi, he put his mother on an ocean liner to go and join him. And his parents did not come back for 2 years. So, and in fact, interestingly, Swamiji's been saying lately, it was a completely futile effort on the part of his father from the point of view of the work that he did. He went to Egypt, he went to the oil fields, he actually found exactly where oil could be found. His own company decided to drop the project, and once Swamiji was firmly established in his new life as a disciple of Master, his parents came back to America. But by then it was much too late. And even Swamiji himself says if his parents had been there, it's quite possible that they could have dissuaded him. But God just made sure that wasn't going to happen. How do you reason all of that out? How do you figure it out looking at the karmic threads from the edge, sort of how everything weaves together to make it happen just as it's meant to happen? And then when Swamiji came to Master, Master began to train his heart. He began to train him to be a devotee, to love God, to chant to God, to pray to God, to open yourself on a completely different vibration than just, these are very interesting ideas. And Swamiji said he understood the need for that because he found his own mind dry and unsatisfying. But the irony was that in a very short period of time, Master gave him intellectual work to do. He made him a writer. He made him the examiner for the people who took the lessons and wrote in their answers to the questions. And all the work that Swami was guided to do, lecturing, teaching, writing, editing, it was all intellectual work. And Swamiji realized that Master wasn't saying to him, oh, you just become a devotee and then your brain turns to oatmeal or anything like that. It's every aspect of our nature is given to us. All of it has to be elevated to the divine level. And I gradually came to appreciate when I met Swami that his magnetism was because heart and mind were in perfect balance. Neither dominated, but both had been developed to the utmost degree. And this is really what the karma of our lives is asking of us, that all the different parts of us need each of us to be brought, everything has its divine expression and needs to be brought into alignment with that divine reality. And we can't sort of excuse our laziness in one area or another on the basis of saying, oh, well, I'm this kind of person and I'm that kind of person. We put all these divine symbols up on our wall here last year. And the one in the far back, which just looks like a circle when you're looking at it from a distance, and only when you get up close to it do you realize it's a yin-yang, which is the two halves of a circle matching each other perfectly with a slight contrast. One is textured, in this case one is not. Sometimes they're black and white when you see them. To my mind, that symbol has always been one of my favorites. You know, a divine symbol is not an intellectual concept first. First, it's just an image that speaks to us beyond the intellect, that we all understand it. The symbol of Ananda, which is on the wall here and over there, also the soaring arc that comes back down again. Swami Kriyananda prayed to Master. He said, we need a symbol for Ananda. He said, that is unique, simple, that communicates a great deal, but that we can use in many different ways. And he said he went into meditation, and what happened was he saw it. It just presented itself to him as a complete form. It wasn't like he thought, oh, well, we should maybe have this part of it, and then we'll have that part of it, and this would be a good idea, and that will be a good idea. When the intellect tries to make things happen, it often tries to get all the pieces and then assemble them all like this. When the heart knows something, it just knows, just like that. And so in a superconscious state, he saw the symbol. And then Swamiji said it took him, he said, about 80 tries. He just, piece of paper after another, because what he had to do was he had to reproduce with his own hand what had just shown itself to him. And then after he looked at it, he saw, oh, look, there's a mountaintop at the bottom. You know, one goes to the top of the mountain. Then the spirit goes up in joyous celebration and dances around, but then comes back down again with, and we can think of it many ways, the devotee comes back to serve, or the grace of God comes down to bless us, and there's even a little shape like a bird, you know, the soaring bird of paradise. You can just look at that for a very long time and see all kinds of images in it. But the mind saw all those things afterwards. First, it was just simply there. I've enjoyed the times that I've worn that symbol. How many times people who have nothing to do with Ananda and have no idea will just say, "That's so beautiful," because it speaks on some level to the truth within us. Now, on our spiritual path, what we're really trying to find at all times is that very subtle sense of "this speaks to me," of living our lives in such a way that we can also understand with our minds why and how this all comes together, but that reasoning process is not the main force in our life. The main force in our life is simply that divine connection. And cultivating that divine connection is really the only responsibility that God has given us. Everything else either follows or doesn't follow from whether we're living in a sense of our inner relationship with everything or whether we're constantly drawing this circle around ourselves. Swamiji often tells the same stories. He tells us a couple of stories about times when he didn't have money at all and he didn't know what to do. But he went forward with what he felt was the divinely inspired action, and everything else just fell into place after that. And he looks at us and he says to us, "Don't worry, don't be afraid. Love God, live for God, serve God. Give your energy to the main reality of your life, and everything else will follow." Recently, Swamiji wrote a very simple affirmation, which I find it so beautiful. He said, May I love you, Lord. May there be so much love for you in my heart that there's no room for any other lesser loves. Now, that doesn't mean that, we now no longer care for our children or our pets or our plants or our garden or anything like that. It just means that let everything that I experience be an expression of that divine love. In every situation that we're in, instead of just thinking, "What do I want? What can I get from this? How can I solve this problem?" let us think instead, "Lord, what would you have me do? How would you want me to act?" And there's no situation in our life, this is what makes it so much fun, that's too small for that. You know, you go into the Long's drugstore, I guess it's CVC drugstore, right near where we live, our community. We've all been going there for years. And, you know, the people who make a career of working in CVC are people for whom that vibration suits them just exactly. And they're an interesting group. And the same group that's in there, and they've been in there for years. And you walk in there, and my mind never quits thinking about these things. And I see this woman, this particular woman who, I don't know if she's a manager or what, but she seems to always be working in there. And her vibration is not similar to mine. She just lives somewhere else. And I look at her and I think, God is equally present in all of us. You know, God loves us all equally, not just Jesus Christ and Krishna, but the same, the divine essence is in the same in every single person. And I think, you know, what karmic condition brought her to have the vibration she has, and where is she going from here? How did she end up here, and where is she going? And then how can I, just in this little interaction, "Yes, I'd like 2 toothbrushes. No, I don't need anything. It's a credit card, not a debit card. Thank you, I don't need a bag." I mean, this is the conversation you're having. But when we stop and think for a moment that God is equally present in all of creation, in every moment of time. So how even an interaction as meaningless seemingly as that, and infuse it with the level of divine magnetism that it actually has. Now, of course, you can't start, you know, taking the woman's hand, "Babaji, Krishna, bless this woman," you know. That gets you incarcerated. You don't really want to do that, because it's not appropriate. She would think you were a lunatic, right? But nonetheless, God is there waiting to be awakened. I used to work retail when I was in high school and a little in my early 20s. And I always remembered, if anybody who came into the store actually saw me as a real and independent person, it would make your whole day. You know, just to be recognized and to be loved. Everybody on the planet walks around with exactly the same needs. We get very sophisticated about it, but it's really just exactly the same, which is, am I loved by God? Am I loved by others? Am I worthy, you know, in this deep-seated fear that maybe I won't be? That's what the mind spins out on us. We move out of the simplicity of the heart, the thwarting cross-currents of our ego, as Yogananda refers to it. It just mixes everything up, and it makes us impossible to sort of tune into these cause and effects realities. But this world is so fascinating. This is what I was saying at the beginning. It's so inexpressibly complicated. And yet Swamiji has emphasized on many occasions, he said, everything seems complicated, but the closer you come into the divine reality, the simpler and simpler it gets. I'll go back to my clerk at the drugstore. You know, just trying to cross all the many lines between us. I'm sure if I went to her house to dinner, I don't know what we would talk about. But because when you're out in the complexity of things, there's all these differences between us. We're vibrating very differently. But as we come back into the stillness, then everything comes together. This is a soul longing for love. This is an individual seeking to be validated. This is a spark of the divinity. This is a bubble of the ocean that will go back into the ocean. We can never underestimate our personal power to both share and experience goodness and to create goodness in this world. We've just been through this national election, which of course for some of you is, you know, some of you were very greatly involved in it. I observe it a little bit farther from the distance because that's not the level on which things are really going to happen. I'm not going to say it makes a difference or doesn't make a difference. I have like no political stand. To be honest, I don't usually vote, and I didn't vote this year because I just can't understand how any of that really works. It's all just waves on the ocean to me. Whereas what we're really doing is that we're really transforming things from the root cause. And all of us as individuals, I profoundly and deeply believe, in our sincere and total dedication to God, we're doing more to save this planet than anything else that we can do. And if from that sincere and total dedication you want to be a political activist, you want to go out and plant trees, you want to have ecological causes, feed the hungry, whatever it is you feel inspired to do, but what will really create the change is that one-to-one reality wherever we are, realizing that the divine is as much present in this person and in this moment as he will ever be. And the only thing that is happening is whether or not I have allowed all the confusion of my mind to distract me from that thought. It never hurts to love people. You're never doing the wrong thing if your heart is open. That doesn't mean that you're always a doormat for people or that you're always just sunshiny and nice. Jesus himself drove the money changers out of the temple because it was the right thing to do. And he angered people to the point where they crucified him. He really didn't keep the peace at all. But he was always in the awareness of the divine. He was always acting as God asked him to act. He was always conscious in every situation that he was not looking at people. He was not looking at hopelessness. He was always looking at the divine itself, looking back at him. It makes life so enjoyable. There's really no boring situations even then. A woman friend once had to ride a bus late at night in San Francisco for her work, and she had to go through a very bad part of town, and she was a little nervous about it, and there was really no choice. It was about midnight. Every night she'd have to ride that bus. She expressed her concern to Swamiji. He said really simply, he said, well, just pray for the people on the bus. And so she started making that her habit. As soon as she sat down on the bus, she would find someone on the bus, and she would just start visualizing that person surrounded in divine light. She would start asking Divine Mother just to pray for that person. Whoever they were, whatever realities they were working with, she would just ask Divine Mother to help them move closer to wherever that they needed to go next. She said she completely lost her fear, and she found that the midnight bus ride was the happiest part of her day. There's an interesting story about Tom Brown. Tom Brown is a tracker, a man who was trained in American Indian ways and was very attuned to nature. And as a boy, he was trained in tracking, which is, you know, following animals and so on. And he used to play out in a wilderness area somewhere, actually in New Jersey. And it was a wonderful wilderness area, but there were a pack of wild dogs there, pets that people had let loose that had just turned feral. And he tells this story once about being pursued suddenly as a boy by these wild dogs. And they chased him, and he chased him up a hill. And suddenly he was at the top of the hill, and the dogs were coming. And they were very dangerous animals. It was not a small problem. And he had no recourse. So he sat down, and he went into his understanding of the infinite spirit. And he just expanded his awareness as he'd been trained as an American Indian devotee. He became one with the universe around him. And he lost outward consciousness. He could go very deep in that. And he just went into that state. In our teaching, you would say he went into the Om. He went into the vibration of the infinite. And then after a time, he came out. And he watched. And when he came out, the dogs were gone. And he was able to look at their footprints. And he could see that the pack of dogs had raced right up to where he was sitting and then became utterly confused. They were right in front of him, but they lost the scent. They could neither smell him nor see him because he had just shifted into another reality. And he saw them rush around looking for him and then just give up and go away. And he had not physically moved. But what he had done in that moment is he had affirmed a greater reality, and that greater reality simply transcended this one. At all times in our lives, whenever we feel bored or sad or frightened or whatever it might be, there's only one way out, and that way is in. And the karmic patterns that keep us spinning, restless, unhappy, disappointed, longing, all of the list, the huge long list that we all have of all the things that bother us, and we keep pushing at them like this, that it's just complexity. There's only one answer to it, and that answer is to come within. It keeps us busy for a lot of incarnations implementing that simple solution. But the sooner we stand in this crazy, complicated world and realize that's the only job I really have to do. I'll entertain myself by getting advanced degrees and making money and raising family and having relationships and writing books and, you know, composing music and all of these things. But that's just how I entertain myself. What I really do at all times is, through it all, stand in that power and in the presence of God. And that's how we unravel what is otherwise seemingly unravelable. We just move out of it into a higher reality. Seek ye first the kingdom of God, and all these things will be added unto us. We are made for thee alone, and our hearts are restless, Lord, until we find our rest in thee. God bless you.